Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. In several past shows, we've looked into the subject of electronic harassment and gang stalking with guests such as Dr. John Hall, Carissa Conti, and Richard Bruce, all of whom were also targets of the organized harassment scene. Even though the word itself, gang stalking, is very likely a term created by the U.S. intelligence agencies, not unlike the word chemtrails. Gang stalking refers to the intense, long-term, unconstitutional surveillance and harassment of a person who has been designated as a target by someone often associated with America's security industry. The topic of electronic harassment has bubbled up into mainstream attention this year, yet electronic harassment cases can be traced back to the breaches of human rights and civil liberties documented in the research of attorney Brian Glick, who wrote War at Home, Covert Action Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It. In January 1988, news of a secret nationwide FBI campaign against domestic opponents of the U.S. policy in Central America are some of the earliest reports made public. In recent news, the Richmond City Council passed a resolution supporting a ban on space-based weapons after a lengthy discussion over whether individuals are being psychologically and physically harmed by exotic government-patented attacks from directed energy weapons. And in Redwood, California, there's another proposed ban. We continue to explore the subject with Robert Guffey. He's the author of the book Camellio, a strange but true story of invisible spies, heroin addiction, and homeland security. Camellio recounts the bizarre series of events that began in the summer of 2003 in Southern California. A heroin addict named Damien temporarily shelters a Marine who deserted Camp Pendleton with stolen merchandise, including 23 pairs of night vision goggles. This caught the attention of the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, or NCIS, who launched a massive gang-stalking protocol against Damien that included invisibility suits and hologram technology. Robert Guffey is a lecturer in the Department of English at California State University, Long Beach. He's a graduate of the famed Clarion Writers Workshop in Seattle. His first book of nonfiction, Cryptoschatology, Conspiracy Theory as Art Form, it was published in 2012. But he joins us today to talk more about his book, Camellio. Robert, welcome to Another News.
Thank you for having me on.
This happened in 2003, before, as you say, most people knew about gang stalking, although it had different names. This harassment tactic and its features existed before that year. Targeted individuals, as you know, range from drug addicts, social outcasts, activists, but also people who are at the wrong place at the wrong time. Would you lay out for listeners the events that led up to the character named Dion becoming the target of organized harassment and how it spilled over into your life?
Okay. Those terms that you mentioned, targeted individual, gang stalking, they didn't even exist in 2003 when this all started for me and my friend. In the book, I call him Dion Fuller. His real name is Damien. I changed all the names in the book except for those people who are public figures. So I changed his name to Dion, but he told me he didn't mind if I used his real name, which is Damien. And I've known Damien since my 16th birthday. On July 12, 2003, and I remember that was the specific date because that was the day I was initiated into the third degree of Freemasonry. I mention that because it actually ties in later on into the story, as you'll see. In July of 2003, I got home from having been initiated, and I called my friend Damien to tell him that I was okay and had not been sacrificed to Baphomet or something like that. And he didn't answer, so I left a message, and he never called back, which was unusual at the time. Usually he'd get back to me within 24 hours or so. A whole week went by without him calling me. Finally, after about 7 days, he calls me and he tells me this incredible story. At that time, Dion was living in the Pacific Beach area of San Diego. His house was kind of a party house. A lot of people coming in and out at all hours of the day and night, doing all sorts of various drugs. And one of these people was a guy named Lee, or rather, he said his name was Lee. Later, we were told his name was Doyle. So in the book, I call him Lee/Doyle because I don't know his real name. So this guy, this kid, Lee, unbeknownst to Damien, had gone AWOL from Camp Pendleton, which is very near where Damien was living at the time. Not only had he gone AWOL, but he had stolen equipment from the base. He had stolen a 9mm Iraqi gun, 23 pairs of high-tech night vision goggles, a DOD laptop computer, and an entire truck. Some of those items he brought with him, apparently, into Damien's apartment. One night during this party, this guy, Lee, pulls out the stolen laptop computer, opens it up, turns it on, and the DOD symbol appears on the screen. At that point, my friend Damien said, grab your stuff and get the hell out of here.
Yeah, that's a bad sign.
It's a very bad sign. And this kid, Lee, said, no, don't worry about it. They can't track this stuff. Within minutes, as if on cue, there's a knock at the door, and Damien goes to the door, and there's a woman there who, in the book, I call Lita Johnson, a special agent for NCIS.
A few minutes? That seems like they're waiting outside or something.
It was very quick. Within, from the moment of him turning the computer on to the knock at the door, it was a very short period of time.
Okay.
And she says, she identifies herself as an agent of the NCIS, which at the time, quite frankly, I'd never even heard of. This was before the TV show NCIS. And she says she wants to search the apartment. Damien, whose dad was a narcotics officer, was very well familiar with his rights and said, go and get a warrant. You can come back. Mm-hmm. She said, I will do that. Damien slams the door in her face, immediately turns around, tells all the people who are doing drugs at this party, pick up your stuff, meaning your illicit substances, and go out the back. They take all the drugs and throw them on his floor, and then they flee out the back. Within minutes, the NCIS come back with the police department, San Diego Police, and it seemed as if they were not working together. There was a very Keystone Cop-like quality to this. They kept kind of bumping into each other and didn't seem to be cooperating with each other. Then none of them cared about the drugs at all. The NCIS woman, what she was most concerned about were these night vision goggles. That was the thing that they were most interested in. And they did not believe that Damien didn't know that this kid had gone AWOL or had stolen all this stuff or was keeping some of it in his house.
The night vision goggles were among the items stolen.
Yes.
By this person named Lee.
Yes, 23 pairs of them. Okay. And they arrest Damien, they arrest this guy Lee, and they take them both down to the San Diego jail. And then for about, 7 days, they give Damien the Abu Ghraib treatment. They're constantly interrogating him, what do you know, who are you working with? They assume that Damien is somehow a part of this ring of people who are selling stolen military equipment to, like, Al-Qaeda or some other nefarious group. This is a very Kafka-esque situation. Damien's sitting there saying, I have no knowledge of any of this. This kid was just sleeping on my couch for a couple of nights. They didn't want to hear any of that. And they wanted Damien to cooperate with them in their investigation of this kid, Lee. Well, Damien had been in and out of jail his whole life. He had a kind of, no-snitch kind of attitude, and he's not the most cooperative person in any case. So he just refused to cooperate in any way because, after all, he didn't know anything. After about a week, they finally let Damien go. And at that point, he calls me and tells me the story I just told you. And we both thought, well, that must be the end of it. Obviously, they figured out that Damien didn't know anything. They let him go, and that was the end of it. Well, that was just the beginning of it, because about a couple of days later, Damien calls me back to tell me that he's being followed around all around town, all around Pacific Beach. 7 jarhead-looking dudes would follow him into the 7-Eleven on Garnett Avenue in Pacific Beach, follow him out again. Just a parade of people. It wasn't like a covert surveillance. It was being done in such a way that he would know that he's being followed.
Normally, when somebody's targeted like this, they'll try to make them kind of go crazy, but it was so overt that it was almost laughable.
Well, yeah, the intent of it was clearly not some sort of covert surveillance. They wanted him to see them. At first, when Damien told me all this, my initial assumption was that he was suffering from some sort of drug-induced paranoia. It seemed too improbable, what he was describing to me. He was describing to me dozens and dozens of people following him around, and it would change. You know, the people would change. One day it would be a new person, a new group of people. So he told me that there were these cars parked outside his apartment. They were shining halogen lights into his window at 3 a.m., blaring music out in the parking lot, just making themselves nuisances to him. And so I said, okay, if that's happening, why don't you take photographs of the license plates or these cars that are following you around? And he actually did that, and he sent me the photographs of these license plates. Oh. And a list of the license plate numbers. So it just so happened that I had a friend who worked up in Seattle, Washington at the DMV there. So he ran all the plate numbers. And it turned out that every single one of them didn't officially exist in the system, in the DMV system. Now, I knew that he hadn't made up the numbers because he had photographed them. In fact, the list of the plate numbers are in the book, around page 50 or so. Mm-hmm. And so it seemed to me that the only possible explanation for that is that they were government vehicles. It's the only reason why they would not be officially listed in the DMV system. So,
okay, I'm wondering about that, too. Is that a common thing that, yes, government vehicles don't have their license plates listed within the DMV?
I believe that is common, yes. And in this case, even if, let's say Damien was making up numbers off the top of his head, you think he'd just accidentally come across, you know, a real a plate number for someone who just happened to be driving around. In other words, if he was paranoid and thought that just some normal citizen was following him, the plate number would have come up in the system.
Right.
You know? So at that point, that's when I started thinking that maybe there was actually some reality to this. And I start Googling things, looking for any information on the internet that would apply to this situation. I came across the website called raven1.net. There was this woman who called herself Raven One, and she had written a little essay called All About Street Theater. And at that time, that was the closest phrase that existed for what is now called gang stalking. They were calling it street theater because simply because of the theatrical way that they go about surveilling you and harassing you. And everything, every bullet point in the essay, in this little article, matched perfectly with what Damien was describing to me. And so I reprinted that little article in the book, and Raven One, whoever she is, has long since disappeared. Her website's gone.
You can find that, though. I know what it is. I know what you're referring to.
You can find that site archived?
It's archived, yes. It's archived on the web.
Everything starts escalating. They're bombarding him with what I would call sort of programmed hallucinations. He would go to the window, and he'd open up the window and look out, and the view that was always there is not there. Now there's some science fictional Boris Vallejo-looking landscape outside with like three moons in the sky. And then Damien would go and open the door, and it would be the scene as it had always been. Go, you know, close the door, come back, look through the window, there it is again.
Wait, during the day?
During the day, yeah. Wait, during the day or night.
Did you actually see the window that he referred to?
Did I see the window?
Do you know the window he's talking about?
I know exactly where it is in the apartment he was living in, but
right.
I didn't see that myself.
He described
that to me.
That I understand, but I was curious if you actually, you know the window he's referring to, and what's on the other side of it?
Oh, just a parking lot, you know, a wooden fence, a parking lot, and, you know, a Vons.
What do you think is going on here? Is this Damien not giving you an accurate description, or it's something else?
Oh, no. It's important to point out that in that same exact area where Damien was living at the time, or these corporations, the SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, and ATC, American Technology Corporation, they were within walking distance of Damien's apartment. And their specialty at that time was developing these exotic weapons, like acoustic bullets, for example, directed energy weapons. And these exotic weapons can be used to create phenomena that if you didn't know any better, you would think your house was haunted. For example, one time I was on the phone with him, and Damien, who's, as I said, he's been in and out of jail. He doesn't scare easily. He was frightened like a little girl because objects on his mantle, you know, were suddenly shattering into pieces as if there were poltergeists haunting the room. And I think that what they were using was what's called acoustic bullets, which is essentially projectiles made of sound, which is what ATC, American Technology Corporation, was specializing in at that same exact time. Both those corporations have since moved from the area. SAIC is split into two different corporations, one called SAIC and the other called Leidos, I believe, and moved to Virginia.
But Damien is now out, and you're getting these reports from him about some very unusual things happening around him. And now you're thinking, this is very real. Something's actually happening to him. I'm curious.
Oh, yes. I was curious because the things he was describing, for example, he started describing people in his house who he could not see. People who were physically interacting with him who were not visible to him. One time he was in the bathroom and he was moving the medicine cabinet, the mirrored medicine cabinet in the bathroom. As he was moving that cabinet mirror, he suddenly caught a sight of them in the mirror, but only as the mirror was in motion. At one point, he could see them as kind of these aura-like dots in the air, a kind of outline of a very small person in the house with him. It seemed to me when he said that, Damien's not a physicist, but I started thinking about, okay, like let's say that there was invisibility technology and they were using it on Damien. If it's light-bending technology, maybe it would make sense that you could see the person in the mirror, but not in the mirror. So I started thinking along those lines and wondering how much of this could, in fact, be true. And in the midst of all this, other things were happening. For example, Damien would be lying in bed at night, and then suddenly a silhouette of a hand would appear on the wall, and the hand would have the shadow of a gun in it, and the hand would tilt down towards Damien's head and then tilt up again. He saw this sort of black, amorphous energy crawl across the carpet of his room, fill up his leather jacket that was lying there on the carpet, and then the leather jacket crawled across the room. In the midst of all this, as this is happening, periodically, the special agent who I mentioned earlier, Lita Johnson, would show up at the door. The people who are parked outside, who are shining the halogen lights through his windows at all day, at all hours of the day and night, they would suddenly back out and leave. And then this car would pull in, and it's Lita Johnson. She'd come out, knock at the door, and say, "Have you changed your mind? Would you like to cooperate now? Would you like to give us any information?" And he would say no, and then she would give him her card and say, "If you change your mind, call the number on the card," and then get back in the car, drive away. Then all the other cars would pull back in, and the harassment would start up all over again.
Geez, they made it real obvious.
They made it very obvious, yes. Now, it's important to point out that Damien had been addicted to heroin for a long time up to this point. Heroin is not a hallucinogen. But also, as I said, I've known him since I was 16, so I kind of know his unique brand of craziness and how it manifests in his mind. And it would not normally manifest in making up whole people in situations like this. So I asked him to give me the phone number of the woman, because she gave him the card with the phone number. So he gives me the phone number, and I call her. And I had a whole conversation with her. The transcript of that conversation is in the book. And she was very disturbed, A, that I was calling her, B, that anyone would be asking her questions about any of this. And I asked her, I said, are you following my friend? And she then launched into kind of CYA language to try to back out of the conversation. She would say, no one in my agency is currently following your friend. That kind of noncommittal language. The whole conversation went like that.
However, another agency is actually contracted anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. That, you know, she was probably literally telling the truth. No one in my agency is following your friend. Mm-hmm. Well, that's probably true. No one in her agency in the NCIS was following him. You know, they contracted out to either another agency or even to they recruit civilians. And during that conversation, I asked her, is it okay for my friend to leave town? And she said, I would not advise that, no. And I said, well, is he being arrested? Why couldn't he leave town? It just wouldn't be a good idea for him to leave town. So it just so happened that this went on from, as I said, July 2003 to about January or February of 2004, and it got worse and worse to the point where Damien was urinating blood, he was losing weight, he had a constant metallic taste in his mouth, which I soon learned was a symptom of electromagnetic radiation poisoning. At around this time, he runs into this beachcomber guy on the beach down at Pacific Beach who's trying to get rid of a black van for about $500. And Damien didn't have the money, so I, without telling him, pulled out the money and wired it to him at the local Western Union. If you've ever Western Union anyone money, you'll know that you have to give a code word for them to pick up the money. So I call him and I tell him, look, I just wired you $500 for the van. Let me give you the code word so you can go pick it up and get out of there. Because we both assumed if he just left town, they would stop harassing him, which was the wrong assumption. And he says, no, don't give it to me now. He was concerned that if I gave him the password over the phone at that moment, someone else, whoever was monitoring his phone calls, would hear the password and go pick up the money before he could get there. So I said, okay, I'll give it to you later. So he hangs up, he gets all his stuff in order, he packs up his stuff. Then he calls me back and he says, okay, give me the password for the money. I'm about to give him the password. I get out like half a syllable, and then suddenly the phone cuts off. So I call him back. I get out another half a syllable. The phone cuts out. This happened like 8 times in a row. Finally, I remembered something that is unique with when you place a collect call with someone. There's a moment there when the operator is talking and asking, will you accept the charges, where you can both hear each other for a moment. So I placed a collect phone call to Damien. And as the operator is asking Damien, will you accept the charges, I yelled out a kind of a hint that I knew he would understand, and I can't say what it is because it's pornographic in nature, but I knew he would understand what the password was. And so I did that, and then the second I did that, the line cuts off again. So he was able to go and pick up the $500 and buy this van. And he puts all of this stuff in the van, and he leaves. He takes off. And the second he takes off, he calls me from a payphone on the side of the road to tell me that there were these little flying saucer-like drones following him. Now, at the time, in 2003, there were not drones just filling up the sky. As you know, now there are people shooting them out of the sky over Dodger Stadium. The drones were not ubiquitous at all, but here he is describing this little saucer-like drone following him wherever he goes. He drives up to Texas. He goes all the way to Minnesota. At one point, he stops into a bathroom in Minnesota to clean up, and a guy comes in he's never seen before. He's washing his hands next to Damien, and the guy says to Damien, listen, if you just give the stuff back, all this will end. And he said it not in a kind of way of like ordering him around. It was more of a pleading tone, like, please give the stuff back because I'm tired of following you around. It was that kind of thing. And then another guy comes in, grabs the first guy by the collar, kind of drags him out of the bathroom as if the first guy had broken protocol in some serious way. Obviously, this encounter kind of spooked Damien. He gets back in the van. He starts driving. He's driving towards Kansas. And on the way to Kansas, the van breaks down on the side of the road. And at about 10 o'clock at night, I get a phone call from these two good old boys who picked up Damien off the side of the road. And Damien proceeded to tell these two guys the whole story that I've just told you. They're like really skeptical. So they ask him, is there someone who can verify what you're telling us? So he gives them my phone number. I pick up the phone And I hear these two guys with this like thick kind of southern accent. They're like, "Do you know this guy, Damien? Are you Robert Guffey?" I go, "Yeah." They go, "They told your friends telling us some like wild fairy tales." And I'm going, no, it's not a fairy tale. This is all real." And I'm trying to explain it to them. As I'm talking to them, one of the guys goes over to the front porch because they had driven Damien back home with them. They go over to the front porch and they start describing to me this little circular drone-like thing that's hovering outside. So it was completely verified for them, as you know, in real time. So I was able to convince them to give my friend some gas, put it in the van, and let Damien go, which they did. So he ends up in Winona, Kansas. There's about 101 people living in Winona, Kansas, and for some reason, when he got to Winona, Kansas, the harassment stopped or paused for a moment. And I don't know exactly why that is. Perhaps it's because there are so few people in the town that if a black van drives in and there's like a parade of jarheads following him around through the town, that would kind of stick out, you know. Also, a lot of people in Winona, Kansas own guns, and no matter how advanced your invisibility technology is, it doesn't prevent you from getting shot by lead projectiles. In Winona, he's able to sit down and kind of collect his thoughts for a moment, and he starts scouring the internet looking for anything that looked like the invisibility technology that he saw. And he saw an essay about this Japanese inventor who'd invented an invisibility cloak, but that didn't look like anything he'd seen. And then finally, he comes across this website, Chameleo.net, run by this guy named Richard Schoengert. And Damien sends it to me and says, "Look at this. This the way he describes this is more like what I experienced." So synchronicity plays a huge role in this story. I go on Richard Schoengert's website, and I'm surprised to see that Schoengert says that he's a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason in the Scottish Rite in Long Beach. Well, I'm a 32nd degree Freemason in the Scottish Rite at Long Beach. So I realize that this guy who said he's invented this chameleonic invisibility technology is in the same lodge as me. So I assume I must have met him, but I didn't recognize the name. So I contact this guy and I say, "Look, I'm a writer. I've interviewed all these people. I'd like to interview you about your Chameleo technology." And he said, perhaps because we were in the same lodge, he was like, "Okay, meet me at the lodge on Saturday." So that Saturday, Damien comes all the way down from where he was to come and meet this guy. So we pick him up, and we take this guy, Richard Schoengert, out to lunch and then back to my office on campus where we interviewed him for about 2 hours. And nothing. I couldn't know if anything that Richard was going to say was going to tie into Damien's experiences. But over the course of that 2.5 hours, everything he said tied in perfectly with what Damien had experienced. Richard had been approached by SAIC, and he mentioned the exact corporation before Damien had said anything about his situation. Richard had been approached by SAIC.
For listeners, that's the same corporation within walking distance of where Damien originally lived.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so he was approached by SAIC about 10 years earlier, before 2003. So we're talking like 1996 or the late 90s. And he had pitched them the idea of this chameleonic invisibility technology. They seemed interested. They kind of vacuumed up all the information, and they disappeared. He had also been approached by the Navy. He took the Navy to his laboratory. He shares a laboratory with Dr. Lev Berger, who's a preeminent physicist. I've been to Lev Berger's laboratory in Hemet, which is in the middle of nowheresville. And Lev Berger has these photos on the wall of him shaking hands with Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon. So Lev Berger is a well-known physicist, and that's Richard's partner.
Oh,
and they have
okay.
This lab.
I gotcha. Okay.
And so they had, they had been pitching people on this idea of the invisibility technology, including the Navy and SAIC, going back 10 years.
10 years ago, from 2003.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so they had had, SAIC had had ample time to take Richard's ideas and manifest them in reality. And Richard mentions to us that he had already initiated a FOIA request because he thought that his technology had been stolen by the military. He says all this before we've said anything about Damien's situation. I start asking him specific questions. I say things like, I may not have mentioned this before, but one of the things that was happening in Damien's apartment was that he would come into his house and it would look like the apartment was growing. He would go into the apartment and it would look like the inside of the apartment was larger than the outside, like Doctor Who's TARDIS. And even neighbors and friends would come over and say, "Is your apartment growing?" Or conversely, it would shrink. It would look smaller on the inside than it had previously. I asked Richard, "Can you use this chameleonic technology to make it seem as if a room is larger on the inside than on the outside?" He said, "Oh, absolutely, you could do this." And then I said, "Well, could you use this for psychological warfare purposes?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, that's in the original patent. I mentioned that. Yeah, you could make someone start seeing all kinds of weird things. You could make them go crazy with this."
So the implication is that the military is using this technology on its own citizens.
Exactly. They stole it from Richard Schoengert, and then they needed to deploy it on someone. They needed to experiment with someone, because I remember a friend of mine asking me at the time, why wouldn't they just experiment with this technology on the base at Camp Pendleton? Well, you know, why would they go to the trouble of picking on some drug addict in Pacific Beach? And I said, well, it actually makes perfect sense, because you would want to experiment with this stuff in real time, in a real situation with someone who doesn't know what's happening. You want that to test the person, observe them, and see when do they notice that the technology is broken down. Oh, he noticed it when he looked in the mirror, or he noticed it when he saw the aura-like dots in the air. And then that way you can gauge what you need to fix before you actually deploy it in a situation in the Middle East somewhere where someone might get their ass blown off.
I was thinking, too, that if you're invisible, but your mass is there, and even if you're a small person, because you said, Damien said there were midgets, but your weight would give you away, especially if you're walking across a wooden floor or something that would give under the weight of a person. Your mass is still there.
Well, that's true. In fact, there's a scene in the book where I mention how Damien was at the beach and he actually saw tracks appearing in the sand as if there were a vehicle following him, but there was no vehicle there. After we spoke to Richard for about, you know, an hour and a half or something, mm-hmm. I then turned to Damien and I said, "Damien, tell Richard your story." So Damien starts telling Richard the entire story. And at first, Richard seemed really very skeptical. But then when Damien mentioned the story about moving the medicine cabinet and being able to see them in the mirror for a second, that struck his interest. And then what really struck his interest, when Richard really sort of leaned forward, was when Damien mentioned that he would see them as these aura-like dots in the air sometimes. And Richard said, that's exactly what the technology looks like when it's not working properly. And so at that moment, when Damien said that, that's when Richard was fully invested in Damien's story, and by the end of the conversation believed that Damien had been used as essentially a guinea pig.
Oh, that's the title of Dr. John Hall's recent book, is Guinea Pig.
That's true.
I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the implication of the mirror artifact. What's going on there within the physics of this technology?
The reason why they're visible in the mirror?
Right.
I asked Richard that, and he said, "Well, basically, it's because they're cloaking the suit, but they're not cloaking the mirror. The way the suit works is that it's essentially a series of cells, and the cells replicate whatever the background is onto all these little cells that are on the suit. So it's this skin tight suit that reflects whatever the background is, just like a chameleon, and." In fact, I remember at the time commenting to Damien that it was rather similar to the blur suit that's in Phil Dick's science fiction novel, Scanner Darkly, which is all about this narcotics officer. They made a film out of it. Richard Linklater made a film starring Keanu Reeves. And this Bob Arctor, this narcotics officer, is wearing the skin-tight blur suit that is essentially the same kind of technology. I remember Damien saying, it's almost like they're taking Phil Dick's ideas and manifesting them in reality. It's too bad Phil Dick didn't write happier books, because Maybe they would just make those into reality instead. Just coincidentally, the very first person who interviewed me about Camellia when the book came out was Tessa Dick, Phil Dick's widow. She has a radio show called Ancient of Days.
Okay.
And I start telling her about all of this, and then she said, well, this reminds me exactly of all the stuff that Phil and I went through in the 70s in Southern California. All the same kind of bombarding of hallucinations, hearing disembodied voices coming through a radio that was not even plugged into the wall. All that stuff happened to Phil Dick and her in the 70s. So this isn't new. He was dealing with directed energy, bypassing the ear canal. There was an invention called the Neurophone. Patrick Flanagan created something called the Neurophone back in the 70s that could bypass the ear canal and put voices directly into your head. I think Phil Dick and his wife were probably dealing with that level of technology in the 70s, not the invisibility technology. In 2003, the invisibility technology was still experimental, and I think that Damien was a guinea pig. I don't think that they're still experimenting with the invisibility technology. I think it's not experimental, it's operational. They're just using it. And it's not just homeless people, drug addicts. They like to focus on people who are on the fringes, you know, homeless people, drug addicts, people who, if they will come out and say that this stuff is happening to them, naturally you would think that they're crazy. But they're also using it on people who are quite prominent. Not a lot of people know that Gloria Naylor, who is a famous, very well-respected novelist who wrote Women of Brewster Place and Mama Day and many other novels, she wrote a book fairly recently called 1996. Her regular publishers would not publish it. They thought she'd gone off the deep end or something. But it's a semi-autobiographical novel, 1996, and it's called that because for her, all these events started for her in 1996. But she describes almost the same exact experiences as what Damien went through. And for her, it started because she was living on an island off the coast of, I believe, Maine. And it just so happened that she lived next door to a guy who had a brother in the NSA. And Gloria Naylor, the guy who was living next door to Gloria Naylor, thought that she had poisoned his cat. Mm. So this guy puts her on the list, contacts his brother in the NSA, and has them put her on, quote, the list. And suddenly she's being harassed. It's as random as that. If people are listening and they think, oh, well, this only happens to drug addicts, it only happens to people on the fringes, I don't have to worry about it. You could be driving on the freeway and you accidentally cut off a special agent, Lita Johnson, and then suddenly, right, you know, she's pissed off at you and she puts you on the list. I mean, it's as out of control and crazy as that. I've been contacted by so many people who are being harassed since the book was published. It's incredible. I had a guy, high-powered lawyer, flew all the way from Minnesota to Long Beach to see me in my office because he had heard me interviewed on another radio show, mm-hmm. and it was suddenly he had heard the only person who was describing what he was undergoing. He actually had to leave behind a very lucrative law firm that he had started. He had to leave behind his house, just put his clothes into a suitcase and leave because he was being harassed in Minnesota. And so he's there trying to figure out, he's this high-powered lawyer asking me why this is happening to him. So I go through it with him. I was like, well, have you ever represented someone who maybe was connected to the military or law enforcement? And he said, well, there was this case where I successfully represented this woman in a harassment, a discrimination lawsuit against the Minnesota Police Department, this African-American woman who was Muslim, and he successfully represented her against the Minnesota Police Department. And after that, that's when all the harassment started with him, the same kind of stuff that happened with Damien. And I told him, well, I think maybe we can just stop right there. I mean, that's about enough, you know. Another guy called me from Thailand. He had been living in Florida, and in the small town in Florida, and he had been having an affair with the wife of the local sheriff of this small town in Florida. Apparently that's a bad idea, because the harassment started when the sheriff found out that his wife was having carnal relations with this other guy. And it was so bad that he left and moved all the way to Thailand, and the harassment followed him to Thailand.
I wonder what they were doing to him, because if it was a small town, that's interesting. So I'm sure they were using other tactics.
The gang stalking stuff, you don't necessarily need the technology to do that kind of harassment. I mean, just the act of following you around constantly. They would stage events where they'd have two people talking to each other, like on the bus. Damien would get on the bus, and there's two people sitting on the seat behind him talking to each other about him, saying negative things about him. This is a common technique that they use. Apparently, these techniques actually predate any of this technology and go all the way back to the Ku Klux Klan. Some of these techniques were used by the Klan to try to push out any African Americans who had moved into their neighborhood post-Civil War.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. Another street theater tactic I read was the removing of mail, and then they'll drive by you with waving your mail in the air.
I actually haven't heard that one, but that wouldn't surprise me. With Damien, all the neighbors moved out. One by one, all of his neighbors moved out. And even the mailman, the normal guy who would come and deliver the mail, they replaced him with a new mailman. And this Tessa Dick told me the same thing happened to her and Phil Dick in Orange County back in the 70s. One by one, the neighbors moved out. New neighbors moved in. And the new neighbors are never friendly. And also, the landlord, when Damien finally told him that he was moving, he was packing all of the stuff into the van and leaving, the landlord looked like he couldn't have been more relieved. He looked like he had been through hell and hadn't been sleeping for the same six-month period that Damien was going through all this. Because apparently, obviously, you'd have to work with the landlord to get all these people moved out and these other harassers, you know, to move in.
Imagine what he had to see and deal with, and probably under an order to be quiet and not say anything to Damien. And I wonder if they paid rent.
They probably did. You have to keep in mind that this is a black hole. The way I describe it in the book is when my very first job teaching was a tutoring job at El Camino Community College, and I went into my counselor's office, because you had to meet with the counselor once a semester for financial aid purposes, and the counselor saw that I had very good grades in English. She said, "We need to hire an English tutor. Would you mind? You sit in the back room here, and you just wait for people to come in, and then we'll pay you X amount every month." And I said, that sounds great to me. Mm-hmm. So the first day I go in the room, there are these two other guys in there who are the math tutors. And I'm sitting there just working on my homework because no one's coming in. There's no people to tutor. And after about an hour, I turn to the two math tutors and I say, what are we supposed to do? And they just sort of laughed and went back to playing video games or whatever it is that they were doing. I soon realized that these two tutors told me that every year the English department got a certain amount of money that they had to spend. And if they didn't spend all of it, they would get less money next year. So they hired the English tutor just so that they could spend that money, and they didn't tell anyone that there was an English tutor. So I would just sit back and collect this money while I was like doing homework. So imagine that on a grander scale, and it's this black budget, and there's all this money they're being given to fight terrorism. Meanwhile, the San Bernardino shooters were posting on Facebook that they were announcing their allegiance to various genuine, real terrorist organizations, and nothing was done about that. The nightclub shooter in Florida had been on the terrorist watch list. He was removed from the terrorist watch list. Meanwhile, there are thousands of people following around Damien, not doing anything to hurt anyone.
It's really interesting, Robert, because the other layer was the goggles, you know, the secret technology that's deployed within the black world, whether it's back-engineered tech or includes directed energy weapons, not unlike what Dr. Judy Wood is pointing out in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. I suspect, and I think you do too, those night vision goggles weren't merely devices allowing you to see at night. The amount of resources used to get at Damien seems to indicate that. And I was thinking maybe they allowed to see people who are using the invisibility technology. Did you explore that with Richard?
Yes. In fact, Richard, that's exactly what Richard thought, because obviously they're not normal night vision goggles. They were so concerned about it. They wouldn't spend all that much time and money trying to get something back that was just a normal night vision goggle that you could order through Amazon.
Right.
There had been something special about it, and it seemed to make sense that it was somehow tied in with the covert invisibility technology, because if the goggles perhaps allow you to see people who are using the technology, or perhaps it allows the person using the suit to see, because one would assume that if you're cloaked, that would do something to your vision, obviously, so you'd have to correct for that. Certainly Richard thought that was the case, that the goggles were used to see through the people who were using the technology.
Did he say that those goggles exist?
Keep in mind that Richard doesn't like have a bunch of these suits hanging in the closet like Tony Stark, you know? Because this was all theoretical, right?
I know, but would, on the theoretical level, because if you deploy this technology out there, then maybe that technology can turn against somebody, so the fail-safe is to have some kind of goggles to...
Right, absolutely. Theoretically, he thought that that made perfect sense.
Hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I was curious about that. The topic of invisibility technology seems to cross over into various fields of the paranormal. David Politis, author of Missing 411 series of books, talks about hunters seeing something in the forest moving around like it's covered in saran wrap. And you have the story from Dr. J with Team Sasquatch, who in his presentation tells of how Bigfoot decloaked in front of him. And then you hear the stories of witnesses saying humans simply vanish before their eyes. What are your thoughts on invisibility technology and then the cross-section of paranormal worlds?
It's interesting that you mention that, because just yesterday I was doing a different interview, and they mentioned to me that they had been listening to an interview with David Politis, and Politis actually mentioned Camellio during his interview and said, you should really read this book, Camellio, by Robert Guffey.
Oh.
So I do think there could very well be an overlap, particularly in regards to... I saw Politis before even Camellio had come out. I saw him speaking in Costa Mesa, which ironically he was speaking not far from where Richard Schoengert lives. It was a fascinating two-hour presentation. His research is really incredible. And right now he's researching what he calls urban disappearances, not just the disappearances in national forests, but in urban areas. And there are these patterns where people will, they'll be at a bar, their friend will go to the bathroom, or they'll go outside for a second for a smoke, and then they'll just disappear. Keep in mind that you could use this covert invisibility technology not just to cloak yourself, but you could use it to cloak others as well. So if you want to kidnap somebody, that would be a good technology to have.
I hear you. I don't know if that's being used in David Paolini's examples because of the lack of a scent that's consistent with every disappearance. There's no scent.
Well, and keep in mind that there could be a sort of mimicking effect going on here. If you get the latest issue of Nexus magazine, I have a follow-up interview in there with Richard Schoengert, and we talk about the inspiration for this technology, the intersection between his career as a scientist and his association with the Rosicrucians and the Freemasons going back to the 50s. And so Schoengert's always had this intense interest in metaphysics, but he also has had this intense interest in real, you know, physical science. And so he talks about how his life in the Rosicrucians led to him thinking about how do you bring about invisibility into the real world, because he had heard rumors for years that there were certain Rosicrucians, you know, elevated masters who had figured out how to be able to cloak themselves from other people using some sort of metaphysical mind power. And that got Richard just curious, well, how would you replicate that in real life? Using technology. Also, Richard has always been interested in UFOs going back to the 60s. And as you know, in UFO stories, a lot of them apparently cloak or disappear or suddenly teleport. that interested him too. How could they? How might they be doing that? So it could be that you have Richard's technology is kind of like a cargo cult version of this advanced technology that perhaps already exists in the form of these UFO sightings that we see. It's also important to point out in the book I mentioned meeting Melinda Leslie, who's a very interesting person. She's a UFO researcher. She claims to be an abductee. She also claims to be a MILAB. And what that is, MILAB means military abduction. That's these people who claim that they've been abducted by aliens and then are returned and then re-abducted by military people who just interrogate them viciously about where they've been, what they've seen, what the technology was like. They all want to know, you know, how did the craft fly? How did it operate? They're really interested in the technology aspect of it and then how to replicate that. And when I met with Melinda, I was started to tell her about Damien's story, and before I could get out five words, she said, "Does SAIC have anything to do with this?" Which I thought was pretty amazing. And I said, "Well, yes, actually, they were just within walking distance of Damien's apartment." And she said, "Oh, how did you know that?" I said, and she said, "Oh, well, SAIC just figures into all of these, many of these MILAB cases that I've investigated. These people who claim to have been re-abducted by the military."
What do you do now with SCIC? Did you talk with anyone from that corporation?
Well, there's no reason to go talk to them because they're not going to tell. they're not going to say, we have invisibility technology and we're experimenting on citizens. You know,
they don't have press releases or a media person to speak with.
They do, but I suspect that what would happen is it would be similar to the conversation I had with Lita Johnson, which was essentially circular and went nowhere. Mm. It was kind of a waste of time. As I said, they split off into two different corporations. One maintained the name SAIC, and the other has used the name Leidos, L-E-I-D-O-S, and is based in Virginia, which is the perfect place for them, so close to the CIA headquarters. So they're still operating. You know, it's like I talked to Richard about this. He tried to initiate a lawsuit against the military. He tried to initiate FOIA requests to try to get actual documentation to prove that they had stolen his technology. But it's so impossible to, A, sue the military to get any information through FOIA requests. They don't have to give you anything that you ask for. If you do get it, it's redacted. What you really need is someone on the inside to tell you, listen, this is the exact serial number of the document that you need. And if you have that, then they would have to give it to you. Other than that, they can find any reason why they don't need to give you these documents. So Richard's sort of in an impossible situation. He could never prove that they had actually stolen this from him. It's all speculation.
It bums me out to hear that, because it's not like the military is running out of money and they could really help somebody like Richard and have his work and technology manifest in real life.
Well, just briefly, he spoke at a spot war conference in Charleston, South Carolina, not long before I first met him. And he was giving a whole speech about this technology. And a woman stood up and said, "You can't be revealing top secret information." And he said, "I'm not revealing top secret information. This is my own private. I have top secret clearance, but this project is a private corporation. It has nothing to do with the military." She said, No. "You're revealing top secret information." And so finally she said, "Okay, you can finish the presentation, but then afterwards we have to go in and talk to you." They took him into a room afterwards, these big burly guys, and they were interrogating him. Finally, he managed to show her the documentation that proved that he was not aligned with any particular military project. This was a private corporation. And once she had been convinced of that, she said, "Oh, okay." But she kind of tipped her hand in the sense that she thought he was revealing top secret information because she must know that there actually was a program going on at that time to develop the invisible soldier of the future. And he had given that talk probably in 2005,
as you've mentioned, what's also revealed here is that if you patent anything, the military can just take it.
Absolutely. It's counterintuitive. You think, oh, the way to protect this technology or whatever my invention is to patent it. No, it's the worst thing to do because the military can legally take anything if they feel it's in the interest of national security. And obviously, you could argue that Richard's technology was in the interest of national security.
Robert, you're in a good spot to tell Damien's story and get the word out on this level of organized harassment, its intent, and the related technology, which usually includes directed energy weapons, satellite technology, and now, as you've outlined in your book, Chameleo, invisibility technology. And the detachment you've cultivated is needed to explain it to a wider audience, I think. And after being immersed in this topic to write this book and discuss it publicly, what would you suggest for those experiencing it and needing help?
The first thing is, well, there's an excellent website called fightgangstalking.com, and there's a part in that website, it's called Tactics on Fighting Back, and it's a lot of interesting little just bullet points, simple little things that you can do inexpensively to combat their harassment. So fightgangstalking.com is an excellent website to look at. But also, the important thing is to maintain a sense of humor about it and also to flip the script on them, because the people who are doing this, they're not the most imaginative people on the planet. They really get very flustered when you suddenly do something that's counterintuitive or something that they wouldn't expect you to do, and then they're at sea. They have absolutely no ability to know what to do because they have very specific scripts they're supposed to follow. So if you read Chameleo, you'll see instances where Damien does something that's completely unexpected and they don't know how to handle it. I suspect they would have been very happy if Damien had killed himself. And we don't know how many people who are targeted individuals who have killed themselves because of this harassment. But Damien's just such a stubborn personality that he managed to, you know, persist. And so that's what you have to do. You have to absolutely persist and not be afraid of them. Because that's the whole point of the technology, is to make you think that you're going crazy. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is so if people are like listening to this and thinking, well, this guy's nuts or he's just making it up, nonetheless, if they have a sister or a brother or a wife who's suddenly going through this, mm-hmm. their first thought might not be, you're going crazy, we need to commit you. Their first thought might be, hey, I heard a guy on the radio talking about this. This sounds like the similar situation, and then maybe they'll give them the benefit of the doubt. So that's my main intent in writing the book.
Robert, if listeners want to reach out to you, how do they do that?
You can contact me through my website, which is www.cryptoscatology.com, cryptoscatology.com, and you can order copies of Chameleo through orbooks.com or through Amazon, I suppose, though a couple of weeks ago I saw that there were independent sellers selling copies of Chameleo for like crazy prices. So you may get a discount if you just go to orbooks.com and buy it there.
Robert Guffey, author of the book Chameleo, A Strange But True Story of Invisible Spies, Heroin Addiction, and Homeland Security. I really appreciate you being on In Other News.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives of the show.
Okay. Thank you.